Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Barbara Massey, a member of the club's book discussion group, and your chair for today. We are also welcoming our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Mary Ellen Hannibal. Mary Ellen Hannibal is the author of four books, most recently The Spine of the Continent, which Publishers Weekly called What Science Writing Should Be, Fascinating and True. In 2012, she was a winner of both the National Association of Science Writers Science and Society Award and Stanford's Knight Riser Prize for Western Environmental Journalism. The Spine of the Continent initiative may be the most daring and important conservation effort of our era, knitting the islands of natural beauty we've preserved or ignored during the last century into a connected, functioning ecosystem to sustain us all. Mary Ellen Hannibal is here to discuss the research and thinking that she has undertaken for her book about science, nature, and the extinction crisis, and the men and women determined to restore America's most epic landscape. We are fortunate to have her speak to us today, and I would like to bring Dr. Carol Fleming, the chairperson of our member-led forums and the driving force of our August programming this year, to our podium to introduce Mary Ellen. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. I just want to take a minute to give you a heads up on the treat you're going to have tonight. I heard Mary Ellen interviewed by Michael Krasny quite some months ago, and in the listening audience, I sat down and heard a fascinating, knowledgeable, fluent, very interesting woman. And I thought, I've got to read that book. I went out and bought it and discovered on the flyleaf that she was not only local, she was part of the volunteer structure here at the Commonwealth Club. Well, knowing Mary Ellen was a very important meeting for me because I was so on fire after what I learned from her that I took the whole month of August to do programming on protecting biodiversity and the citizen scientist. So I want you to know that it was her influence that led to this whole month of programming. And not only that, with her I was able to identify and contact the most important people we could get to speak on this topic. Believe me, I could not have done it without her. So she gave me inspiration, she gave me contacts, she got the people in here so that members of the Commonwealth Club had access to some of the finest minds in citizen science and biodiversity that could possibly be accumulated here. And so, Mary Ellen, I want to say thank you. You've given so graciously to us, and to you, you got a treat coming. Thank you.
Well, that was really kind. Thank you very much, Carol. And it's actually really to the point of what this book is all about that one of the ripples out from it is indeed another iteration of connectivity. So this word connectivity is at the heart of what the Spine of the Continent is all about. And all of these speakers that were here this month and all of the programming that went on represent all different facets of different kinds of people doing something on behalf of nature, which needs everybody's help, and everybody has a contribution to make to helping nature. So what is the Spine of the Continent? I found out about it writing my previous book called Evidence of Evolution. So Evidence of Evolution is a book based on the specimens at the California Academy of Sciences. Now, the specimens of the Academy are collected by taxonomists. Taxonomists are like historians and archivists of nature, and they collect actual physical specimens representing types of biodiversity, and they identify them very precisely and put them on the tree of life. This is very, very important work. You might not know that this kind of worm, that he looks exactly the same as this other worm, is very profoundly different from it, even though they're related, but one might be nocturnal and the other diurnal. This is very important if you are trying to restore an ecosystem and you put the wrong kind of worm back in it. But they're understanding nature in a very kind of academic way. And the evidence of evolution is about how we know that evolution unfolds through taxonomy. These scientists are not conservation biologists. Conservation biology, it turns out, something I learned when I researched this book, is only about 30 years old. And it was born from scientists studying population evolution. Paul Ehrlich, you probably all know who he is. He wrote The Population Bomb in the 70s, very prominent population biologist, and he was the graduate professor of Michael Soule, who I profile in depth in this book. Michael Soule is the literal father of conservation biology. He is not the only person who made it happen. Other big names like Jared Diamond and E.O. Wilson signed in on it and have been a part of it ever since. But Soule is the person who declared it a discipline and set up a society and helped get a journal going, and it's been going for 30 years. But it was over at the Academy when I was interviewing scientists. So here are these old-style, kind of older white guys cut in sort of a classic scientist mode. So there are two answers to everything, right and wrong. There's not any gray. Science is everything. Everything else is subjective and probably nonsense. So there's a way things work with this type of scientist. And they have a lot of information, but they see things in a very distinct way. Well, three of these guys, while I was interviewing them, wept tears, literal tears, when I was interviewing them. And I was quite taken aback. By the third person crying, I thought, I was freaked out. I was really, frankly, freaked out, because this is not a crowd that cries. Why are they crying? Because the study subjects that they've devoted 40, 50 years to are disappearing. The places where they study these creatures are changing so fast that biodiversity is slipping through their fingers, and they are not able to get this message adequately out to the public. Now, I'm an interested public person, you know, in biodiversity, and I've given money to various organizations, the Sierra Club and to the Nature Conservancy for years and years and years. But I realized I don't understand this crisis as much as I need to. And I also felt the despair coming from these people, like, what can we do about this? So another scientist at the Academy, she's no longer there, Healy Hamilton, she's now become the chief scientist of something called NatureServe. But Healy told me about the spine of the continent, and I do profile some of her work. She told me that the spine of the continent is an initiative started by one of her all-time heroes, Michael Soule, to apply what conservation biology has hammered out as what nature needs to persist. And basically the concept is connectivity. So the spine of the continent represents North America, which the Rocky Mountains, from Mexico to Canada. And the Rocky Mountains are a huge defining feature of our continent. They practically take up half the continent. There are other mountain ranges towards the west coast. We have our Sierras, and there's other mountain ranges that are not part of the Rockies. But it is the pathway by which animals, plants, and people first came over the Bering Strait and inhabited North America. There's a long sort of complex story to that, and different pulses of creatures and people. They would come. So at one point, they went down to South America. Then there was a pulse coming back up. This is all the speciation. These are the kinds of things that the Academy scientists are saying, are figuring out, like, when did this new species get born and where? Is it from South America? Is it from where? So the reason that the spine of the continent is the focus of this initiative is that it's still where we have quite a lot of wilderness still intact. And what intact means is that the typical and classic suite of creatures are still operating on it. like grizzly bears and wolves, which we don't have any left in California at all, not a single one. And I said to a scientist who is part of the book, Jim Estes, I said, do we really need grizzly bears and wolves? I mean, California hasn't had them for years, and we're fine. And he said, well, no, we're not fine, actually. You know, we have a lot of problems with wildfires, and this wildfire in Yosemite right now, you know, has a relationship with the carnivores who once traversed on the land and are no longer there. There's many other things that contribute to what's gone on there as well. But there's still lots of these animals, especially up in Canada. So the grizzly bear, I opened my book up in Canada, tracking grizzly bears with Rob Watt, who's been a park ranger in Canada for over 30 years, more than 30 years, and knows everything about them. And one thing I really felt very viscerally there is that when you are tracking wildlife, when you know that they're there, they know that you're there, and they're watching you as well. And when you really think about wildlife watching wildlife, of course they're watching you. This is what they're doing all day long. They're watching each other. Who's going to try to eat me, and who am I going to try to eat? What do I feel like doing today, kind of a thing. And there were definitely grizzly bears in the vicinity where we were with Rob Watt, and I was glad to only see evidence of them and not actually a real grizzly bear. So this brings us to one of the connectivity concepts. So for example, we have about 660 grizzly bears in the Yellowstone region. Those bears are separated from others of their kind, but there are other populations of them all the way going up to this vibrant, big population of grizzly bears in Canada. If the grizzly bears in Yellowstone cannot get linked, cannot sort of do a genetic baton pass, cannot interbreed with others of their own kind from different populations, those individual populations will go extinct. So that's one kind of connectivity that different populations, and this is why this comes out of Paul Ehrlich in population biology, that this was one of the first things these ecologists, they weren't really even ecologists, but they were looking at populations. It's something that Darwin wondered about. It's something that instigated Darwin's thought. He was in the Galapagos, and there's different populations of animals and plants that are different but similar to ones that he's seen on the mainland. How can that be so? There must be a relationship. There's different numbers of these animals and plants on different sizes of islands. Why is that? These are some of the questions that Darwin asked and that led him to his theory of natural selection. So grizzly bears are among those animals that have been pretty much extirpated, and extirpated means taken, just destroyed entirely off of our landscape, along with many other animals to our detriment. E.O. Wilson is credited really profoundly with kickstarting what's called conservation biology from a book that he wrote with someone called Robert MacArthur, who died young, called The Theory of Island Biogeography. And The Theory of Island Biogeography, the reason it was profound and still is that it was bringing math to the question of what's going on outdoors. So this is where ecology had been a science of great insight, great observation, but it was very subjective. And nature is so complicated that basically ever since in these decades and still today, what conservation biologists strive to do is to create mathematical formulas that represent what's going on in nature to take out the human subjectivity in terms of what's going on out there so that we can really, really figure it out, because we have these human biases that we don't even know we have. So what they did is they used a map made by a botanist of a county in Wisconsin, and showing this map, the first map was in 1831, shows this county as a gray, and that's all forested. And then as human settlement comes to that area, the forest gets to be smaller and into little pieces. So what the theory of island biogeography was saying is that human development is making islands out of natural areas. So that was published in the early 60s, well, mid-60s. And believe me, since then, this rate of making natural areas into islands has only accelerated. And we're practically at a place where you know, we're almost half and half with human development and the rest of nature. So one big question that conservation biologists and everybody really should be asking is, well, how much nature do we need? And then you can't just have nature. This another huge question of conservation biology is, you can't just have nature in these isolated islands, as illustrated by the grizzly bears, for one reason of connectivity. Those species in one island have to be able to get to the next island in order to keep their genetic vibrance. But how are they going to get there? Now, a grizzly bear can move from one to the next, but not every kind of animal or plant can move. They need to have continuity. One of the ways that we've broken up continuity on the continent, a huge way, is roadways. There are millions and millions of roads on our continent. Yesterday, I was driving back from Western Massachusetts to Boston. I dropped my daughter at college, and I was, you know, I'm looking for the biggest interstate possible to get me as fast as possible to Logan Airport and then fly home. This is the way I think of the landscape, right? I'm getting from here to there. Well, what if you're an animal or a plant? That big highway has interrupted the flow of your movement. The other thing is that our roadways tend to move east-west. Our biggest arteries are east-west. Animal movement tends to go north-south. So we're actually bifurcating it in many places. When I first started this book, one of the things I dreaded having to cover was roadkill. It's a big part of conservation biology because it's a big problem. But as I got into the subject of roadkill, I began to love it because it's been approached in very interesting and poetic ways and has come up with really beautiful solutions, overpasses and underpasses. There was a big initiative in Montana spearheaded by the Kootenai tribe, which is a very together tribe up there, and the state of Montana wanted to twin a roadway that was already there. And part of that goes over sacred ground. So the Salish Kootenai tribe, their spokesperson, their biologist, her name is Whisper Camel. Whisper Camel said, okay, if you want to do this in exchange, we want all these underpasses and overpasses built. And they enjoined all of these, they had a competition for coming up with the most creative designs of underpasses and overpasses. And one of the design teams actually used Temple Grandin. Do you know who she is? Temple Grandin is autistic, and she's kind of an animal whisperer. She brings the perspective of animals. She's hired by slaughterhouses, for example, to make the experience of getting becoming meat for cattle, for example. She makes it nicer for them. She really has this identification with animals. So she was one of the consultants on one of these designs. This is the kind of thing. Also, this interdisciplinary thing of, you know, landscape ecologists, wildlife biologists, engineers, everybody coming together to solve this problem is something that makes me love the subject of roadkill now. So we see the world very differently than animals and plants do. One of the more recent projects of Michael Soule is something called Wild Lifelines. And conservation biology, as a lot of science, does its work through maps. And has just boomed because of what we can do with mapping software, GIS, satellites. One of the maps that he's created with, that Michael Soule has created with a researcher at Colorado State, Dave Theobald, is they called Lifelines, Wild Lifelines, which describes where there's still places along the landscape for animals and plants to move. So it's sort of the reverse or the negative to our positive of where there's still room for animals and plants to move on our continent. The trouble with their map is that some of the places where they show room for animals to move are not really intuitively geared to what animals would use. So some of the east-west particularly corridors where animals could move, they're not likely to use that. But the lifelines show really big, thick areas of connectivity in the Rocky Mountains and in the West. And that's another reason why the spine of the continent as the landscape to still preserve is really, or to preference, is very important because it's still there. That connectivity is still there. So Healy Hamilton, who told me about the spine of the continent, does very cutting-edge work and has been hired by various nonprofits along the spine of the continent to project where animals and plants are likely to persist in the future. So one of the sad truths of where we're at now is that with climate change, plants and animals are being forced out of their traditional habitat because basically habitat is defined most usefully in the simplest possible way by temperature and precipitation. So both temperature and precipitation create a niche that animals and plants are comfortable with where they can persist. But this is shifting because the climate is changing. So what Healy Hamilton does is uses vast statistical programming and computing power to project where species are likely to persist under different climate scenarios in the future. So she has been using the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, projections of levels of greenhouse emissions from the last, from the fourth, whatever they call it, their last report. There is a new report coming up, and actually throughout the fall you'll be seeing papers coming out in of reporting from scientists who are contributing to the next assessment. So this will be the fifth assessment. She uses the fourth assessment. And she shows that, for example, she could show on a map where Canada lynx are likely to be able to live today. She doesn't know precisely that Canada lynx are in these shaded areas that she shows on her maps, but they could live there according to the temperature and precipitation. They're likely to live there. Then she shows where they're likely to be able to persist under the worst-case scenario of the last assessment. And believe me, it is a lot less than where they can live now. So we're talking about shrinking their habitat out from underneath them. Then she has a little bit more optimistic scenario, which is if we reduce our carbon emissions significantly, they'll have more territory than not. Now, just recently, in the last couple of months, some really important studies have come out. One was something that kind of fell on the cutting room floor, was research. I spent some time with this woman, Wendy Moore, who's an entomologist. She studies beetles in the Sky Islands, which is at the lower end of the spine of the continent. And I can't believe that more people don't know about the Sky Islands because they're the most spectacular, beautiful mountain range. They're called the Sky Islands because, you know, back in the Pleistocene, they were separated from each other. I'm not going to get the geology completely correct, but each mountain is far away from the next one, so that they have very different assemblages of species because the species have evolved separately from one another. And they're so tall and it's so arid down there that on a single Sky Island mountain, you have the same elevational gradient of biomes that you have if you go from Mexico all the way to Canada. So you're going from desert to alpine, right? But you go from desert to alpine on a single mountain in the Sky Islands. They are just an amazing place. There's more bird life in the Sky Islands than anywhere. And it's just a cosmic place because you will see a huge cactus, and then there will be a pine tree, and then you'll see a heron flying by, and then you'll see these tropical birds. It's this fascinating place where these different kind of assemblages come together. So Wendy is doing a climate change experiment, and she's trying to track how bugs might be changing their movement along. She's using Mount Lemmon, which is the first mountain named for a woman, for a white woman in the country. And she was, Sarah Lemmon was a botanist, and I think she named the California poppy, was one of her claims to fame. So Wendy is actually married to Rick Bruska, who started out as a marine biologist, but he said to himself, I went out with them on a field trip, and it was really fun and really hard work setting these bug traps and getting the bugs out of the traps. And what he realized, he said to himself, bugs and insects are very highly correlated with plant life. So you can tell a lot about the plant life from what bugs are there. They're very closely connected. So one of the things that's difficult about conservation biology is that in order to tell what's happening with nature now, you have to compare it to how it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 100 years ago. But there are precious few data sets from long ago. One of the most, the mother lode really, is the Grinnell survey in California. So Joseph Grinnell founded the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at Berkeley, and he was this genius person who saw even almost 100 years ago that California was going to change fast. And he wrote in one of his journals, the scientists of the future are going to want to know what was here. So he did this very meticulous survey of California, part of California. Today, scientists at Berkeley have resurveyed Grinnell's survey. And what their work shows is that animals and plants have moved quite a bit. And you can correlate that with how the temperature has changed. So Rick Brusca, a senior scientist, knowing that in 1963, a very famous ecologist, Robert Whitaker, had inventoried the Sky Islands, he went back with Wendy and he made a re-inventory of the botany there. So his work just was published in the last month on this, and his work shows this enormous change in elevation in only however many years that is, 50 years. And it totally correlates with the temperatures getting hotter. So in sum, temperature gets hotter, the plants move to try to get to a cooler temperature. Now, when you're on a mountain, you can change where you are, your temperature, pretty significantly if you just move north slope to south slope because of the angle of the sun. And in the mountains, there's all sorts of nooks and crannies. There's a lot of different habitat in mountains. It's another reason why the spine of the continent is so important. There's more habitat there than there is, say, in a desert. If you are a plant needing to move across the desert to get to 1 degree difference, you're not going to make it because you got too far to go. If you are on a mountain, you might make it because you can do that. To mention a really interesting thing about the Grinnell resurvey, the plants and the mammals are moving north, as might be expected. Some of the birds, however, are moving south. And the ornithologist, Steve Bisinger, who's the spearheading the bird resurvey, told me that he suspects the birds are trading off precipitation for temperature, that they're pursuing the different precipitation over the temperature, and they have more tolerance to be able to go back to tolerate a bigger temperature differential. So this brings up what climate change is doing to nature. It's thwacking it. Now, if you move the plants one way and the birds go another way, sometimes that's okay and sometimes it's not okay because that bird might pollinate that plant. When you have butterflies moving one way and their host plants moving another way, you're taking that relationship out of whack, and they need each other. Some of them might find substitutes, and some of them might not. So this is where climate change is really a huge challenge for nature, and there will be winners and there will be losers. Another big piece of research that just came out a couple of weeks ago is that redwood trees are growing faster than ever before. So they are going with the hotter temperature. They're going, yay, we got more sun. We're going to create more biomass. And it's a positive story. It's a very complicated story as well because because they're in this fog belt, they're somewhat protected from climate change. But redwood trees create this biomass that stores carbon. So that's a bonus that's happening. So there's also, it's just thwacking nature in all these different ways. So I learned so much doing this project, and two of my favorite people have to do with beavers, and I would like to write a book about beavers because I was totally blown away when I went down the path of the beaver. So I went out in the forests of Utah with Mary O'Brien, And Mary O'Brien is a passionate, devoted scientist. She's about 65. She's thin as a rail. She's absolutely beautiful. She's of Scotch-Irish or Scotch descent, but she looks Native American because her skin is so tan and wizened, and she has those huge cheekbones. And beaver are her passion. She wants to bring beaver back to the waterways of Utah because the waterways of Utah are totally degraded because beaver were extirpated, taken entirely off of the landscape by the mid-1800s. So when I went down this path of what happened to the beavers in Utah, I discovered that basically this is what happened to America and Canada. And it turns out that when the Pilgrims landed in Massachusetts, they had no way to make a living. They had no way to feed themselves. Half of their number had died on the Mayflower. They owed money back to the people who had given them money for the trip. They needed to find a way to make a living. And they nearly perished. And finally, Native Americans met up with them and showed them how to hunt beaver, how to trap beaver. So they started to trap beaver and send the furs back to England, and they started to make money. And this became the foundation of the fur trade. Now, the fur trade had gone on from the Russians over in the Alaskan area. Fur was a big commodity. You can think about how long ago that was. There was no central heating. Beaver fur is incredibly warm and incredibly soft. So everybody was wearing furs back in the 1400s, 1500s. Anybody who could have it, who could afford it, was wearing it. So what happened is beaver became what is like oil today. It became the foundation of the economy, of the building of the United States. So it wasn't the United States then. It was the French, the Dutch, the British, and the Native Americans. And there was this huge market in fur. And what everybody did is they extirpated or completely harvested every single last beaver in a place, and then they moved west. So there was not a single beaver left in Massachusetts or in New England by the time it gets to the mid-states, what's now the mid-states. Another fascinating thing is that the Native American tribes were very, very central to this commerce, and for a long time, they were in charge of it. I mean, it was all about territory. It was all about who had control over the territories, who got the most money from the beaver furs. When you take beaver off of the landscape, you change everything. And I have a bone to pick with Thomas Jefferson. Such a smart guy about everything except for his real lacunae in what he was noticing. So by the time you get to Thomas Jefferson, you can read in his notices to Lewis and Clark, you know, there's between the lines is go find me beaver territory. What they needed, they still needed money, and he wanted the big fat beaver that were in the West, and they were hoping to get this, you know, passageway where they could ship the furs directly back and not have to go around the ocean to bring the Western beaver around. But even Thomas Jefferson, who noticed how badly the Puritans and the settlers farmed, did not notice that when you take beaver off of a waterway, you change the hydrology system. So what beavers do is they create habitat for other creatures. They slow down, they build their dams, they slow down the flow of water, it changes the temperature of the water, it cleans the water. They even retain a sort of secondary level of water that they can release in a drought. They know instinctively exactly where to put their lodge so that when in places where the water freezes, they have exactly enough room to breathe still underneath. A whole host of other species come in to live when beaver are there. There are more insects, there's more amphibians, reptiles, there's more fish, there's more birds, small mammals, medium mammals, large mammals. Everything's going on when beaver are on the landscape. When you take the beaver off of the landscape, 3/4 of that disappears. And what you need for a healthy ecosystem is everybody to be on it. And this goes all the way down to the geological. This is they just do everything. When you look at what beaver do in like the course of 2 years, when you put beaver back on a landscape, it is very dramatic. All this vegetation comes back, native vegetation that keeps the soil in place. When you don't have beaver on the landscape where they are historically they should be, and you don't, well, let me put it this way. The next thing that happened after the beaver were taken off the landscape, there was no way for people to make a living on the land. So that, this is when cattle were inserted onto the landscape. Cattle are the next big natural disaster to happen to our landscape, because cattle are not they're not evolved in many of the landscapes where they graze. Some places they are, and some places they're still still useful for the landscape. But cattle will eat the vegetation all the way down to the ground, the native vegetation, which then invites invasives to come in. So another really, and invasives are bad. For example, Kentucky bluegrass is an invasive that will come in when the native vegetation is gone from riverbanks. Kentucky bluegrass is rhizomous, and so all of the root system is connected. It's like a piece of carpeting. So when a flood comes, that whole thing is ripped up, and then the soil is bare, and it erodes, and you've got muddy, silty, eroded water. Native vegetation has long roots into the soil, and when you have long native roots into the soil, this fascinating thing called mycorrhizal fungi grow on the roots. Mycorrhizal fungi actually siphons carbon into the soil, and it creates this incredibly rich, dense soil, which then makes a nicer habitat for more native grasses. But it also sequesters carbon. Right here in California, in Point Reyes, there's a Marin carbon ranch, where John Wick, and using scientists who are helping him, is creating they're quantifying how to increase the carbon sequestration in the ground. Now, using cattle, actually, if you graze them the right way, they can stimulate the growth of the native plants and not hurt the environment. If you do it the wrong way, which it's mostly done wrong, then that doesn't happen. So beaver, carbon, healthy soil, and cows all then come to the next phase of American history, which is when we took all of the big predators off of the landscape. So this goes back to Gifford Pinchot, who famously was the founder of the Forest Service and Teddy Roosevelt's good friend. And he thought he was doing the right thing, and he did some really terrible things. One was he encouraged and aided and abetted this huge movement to eradicate predators. So you put all of these ranches on the land. You're trying to get people to stay put, manifest destiny. Manifest means, you know, wrought by hand. You have to keep those people there to give them a way to make a living on that soil. You want to populate your new country. So there was all this politics that went on, and basically ranchers demanded that the federal government protect their cattle against predation, take the predators off, especially the wolves. So basically they thought this was like getting rid of mosquitoes, right? Just something terrible, take them off. So why this is not a good idea has only really been forged by scientists in the last 20 years. And the sort of poster child of this lesson is at Yellowstone, although it's been documented and analyzed in a lot of other places. But in Yellowstone, the last wolf was extirpated, taken off. There's two little wolf pups. There's a picture of them in the back of a pickup truck going to their destiny, looking pretty scared as well. They might. In 1926. By the 1990s, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, basically because there was a feeling that where you could have all the natural animals on a national park, you should. Nobody really knew that deeply, although there were people that had the insight that this would help the ecosystem, but nobody had it really down, like what that was going to do to the ecosystem. So the story that I tell in my book is this hydrologist, Bob Beshta. So he's a hydrologist. He studies water. He went to the Lamar River in Yellowstone to study the water, to study the river. And he tells the story that he got there in the 90s, and it was a mess. It was silty. It was degraded. It was eroding. There was no native vegetation on the banks. There was no songbirds around. There was very little biodiversity on the Lamar River. And he was very upset about that and came back every year to try to figure out what was going on with the Lamar River. And over that period of time, the wolves happened to have been reintroduced. And over that period of time from 96 now, he still goes back every year, the waterways of the Lamar have improved. They have healed. They're not completely healed, but they have improved hugely. And he and many other scientists have figured out something that is called a trophic cascade. So trophic means food, cascade means to fall. And it turns out that big predators, wolves and grizzly bears, have, you know, there's a smaller number of them at the top of the food pyramid, but they have an outsized forcing effect on the rest of it. And in summation, what happens, in Yellowstone, you have superabundant elk and deer and cattle eating the greenery. For many years, there were no predators. So these elk were hanging out at the riverside, eating and eating and eating, and they eat down below what's called where the leader of the plant can recruit. So these native plants just cannot grow up, ever. Then the invasives come in and everything goes, all of the native vegetation is gone. When the native vegetation goes away, so do the beaver. They have nothing to build their dams with and they have no food, so they leave. The beaver leave and so does a host of other creatures. You bring the wolf back, and what happens, one biologist calls the ecology of fear. It's not that a wolf can take down an elk very easily. They really can't. The biggest wolf you'll ever see is about 120 pounds max after a fantastic summer, you know, and a big alpha male, 120 pounds absolute maximum. A bull elk is 900 pounds, and the female is 700 pounds, and they're strong. And in something like 80% of all wolf-elk interactions, the wolf does not get dinner. And in fact, they get injured. But so it's not that we're bringing the wolves back reduce the number of elk by very much at all. And think about, like, one pack of wolves taking down one elk takes them days to do it. Days to do it. They, you know, they circle it, they harass it, and of course they take out the ill, the babies. They go for the weaker parts of the elk herd. That carcass feeds grizzlies, wolverine, lynx, little mammals after that, eagles, everything. That one carcass does a tremendous amount for the whole ecosystem. So what was quantified is that when wolves are on the landscape, the elk behave differently. They are wary that there's a predator in the neighborhood, and they look over their shoulder every 2 minutes, and they keep moving. And that behavior change is enough to give the vegetation a chance to recruit. This has a huge effect on the carbon cycle. We think of the atmospheric carbon cycle all the time, right? That's what we're hearing about, greenhouse gases. Got to reduce emissions. Indeed, we do. We also have a geological carbon cycle, which is densely and deeply related to the atmospheric carbon cycle. And that's where we sequester the carbon in the ground. And that's where the growth comes up from the ground, the soil. All of these creatures, all this biodiversity and the relationship among these levels of biodiversity are basically the processing plant between the atmospheric and the geological carbon cycles. We can't not have these processes, these relationships of nature. We have life on Earth. We have our life because of this relationship that animals and plants have. Now, it's difficult, right? We don't like the idea of predation. I saw a coyote kill a deer on Balunas Lagoon in the spring. I was bird watching, and I saw this activity. You know, here's this incredibly beautiful vista. I mean, what's more beautiful? I was up at the Audubon Canyon Ranch looking down at the Balinas Lagoon. I'm like, what am I looking at? I'm seeing this activity, and I realize I'm watching this big coyote kill a deer. And the deer was alive, and the coyote was, you know, biting its stomach And it was shocking. It was so ugly and horrifying. But I'm sitting there going, this is just necessary. I didn't watch the whole thing. I went and looked at the egrets. I came back. The deer was dead. The coyote was gone for a minute because it came back. When the coyote left, the raptors were down on the carcass. I'm like, okay, this is it. You know, this is the carbon cycle. This is how this works. We don't have a replacement for this. We may not like it, but we don't have a replacement for it. And so we have to tolerate predation, even if it's ugly. So this, I don't know. I have to ask a scientist if they really kind of object to how I talk about this. But I think about connectivity in two ways, horizontal and vertical. So kind of horizontal is like across the landscape. Like one grizzly bear population has to connect across the landscape with another one. And then the vertical connectivity, which is a relationship between all of these different trophic levels. So one of the fun things about conservation biology is giving us this kind of different way of looking and conceptualizing the landscape. And there's all sorts of different ways that conservation biologists do this. Then create the yellow, Y to Y is a famous part of the spine of the continent, and it's a nonprofit that really covers the top part of the spine of the continent. It's one of the most effective nonprofits really doing the work it sets out to do. It's a little easier for them in some cases than it is farther down where we are. There's less population to get in the way. But they, you know, defined this Yellowstone to Yukon ecoregion as this is how we're going to put our arms around the landscape. And then there's other ways of putting your arms around the landscape. In the last years, couple of years, this wolf dispersed from Oregon. We have no wolves in California, but this wolf, OR7, came down to California. And he was radio collared, so scientists could track his doings. And what OR7 showed is that connectivity really works. So you can see OR7's journey. If you go online and just type in OR7, there's a couple of really great maps online, and you can see that what OR7 did is he traveled through protected areas to get down to California. And I found this very poetic, actually, because it's almost like 100 years of conservation effort, you know, all different kinds of efforts. So some of these protected areas were protected 100 years ago, some of them 20 years ago. Some were private landowners donating land. Some was federal land, state land. All different ways of protecting different pieces of land contributed to this lifeline for OR7. So I was telling some sixth graders about OR7, and one of them said, "Isn't he lonely in California?" And I said, "Yes, he's looking for a mate." And in fact, he did not find one. So he went back to Oregon, actually. So we don't have a wolf in California at the moment. When I was researching this book and I'm thinking, is this working? The Spine of the Continent is an initiative of nonprofits all the way down the spine of the continent, kind of holding hands across their jurisdictions to make sure that all of the important places where animals are likely to be moving are protected. Funding comes and goes for these people. It's a huge landscape. They're super committed people doing the best they can. There need to be more people helping them. But what I did really see is that this connectivity concept has penetrated all the way to state and federal policy. And one of the great things that has happened in the last couple of years is the establishment of something called landscape conservation cooperatives across the country. And this is from the Department of the Interior. And these are groups of people that are state, federal, tribal, county. All of these cooperatives are comprised of all sorts of different people to coordinate their activities with each other. And I talked a little bit in the book about the Great Northern LCC, which is one of the really, really effective ones. And it's interesting because the Great Northern covers approximately the same kind of territory as Yellowstone to Yukon, but they've defined the territory a little bit differently. There's all sorts of different ways of looking at the landscape. The California Landscape Cooperative is another really effective one. It's really something to be proud of. So I learned so much about animals. Cats get the kind of top billing of top predator because of the retractable claw. Mountain lions have persisted as the most persistent top predator on many landscapes. We have them here in California. When I was at the High Lonesome Ranch, this is a chapter of my book, there was a downed elk that the biologist that I was with was hoping might have been killed by a wolf, because they're wanting wolves to come back to Colorado where they don't have them, because Colorado has degraded landscape that they want to help heal with bringing wolves back. But when we looked at the elk, it was clearly a cougar kill, because it was in a culvert, and there was this gigantic elk with big raptors on it. And this is how mountain lions and jaguar do their killing. They stay in crevices, they hide, they wait for their prey usually, and a mountain lion asphyxiates the prey at the throat. And these big cats are like your house cats, they don't like hair. So next to this gigantic elk, there was this curtain of hair on a white snowy embankment where the cougar had, you know, fastidiously taken the hair out of its mouth and put it on the snow. Now, a wolf is not quibbling about hair in its mouth, so that's one way you knew that it was not a wolf kill. Jaguar get the top billing of all. They have been revered in many cultures for their incredible skill and strength. They aren't that much bigger than mountain lions, but they are stronger, and they kill with a single bite to the head. And that's very efficient. If you're going to get killed by a large carnivore, I hope it's a jaguar, because it will be over like that. Ocelots and jaguar are coming up from South America over the border. So this is a very big issue on the spite of the continent, because the single most biggest disruption to wildlife movement known to man is the border wall, of course, between Mexico and the U.S. It doesn't stop people, but it does stop animals. And it's fraught in Arizona and New Mexico. I mean, and you see a really kind of crazy, schizophrenia toward wildlife down there, because they've done incredibly good things to protect habitat and to welcome these creatures back. Jaguar historically ranged as high as Monterey, and they are coming back. I mean, you could say that they are just recolonizing where they once lived, but most of the jaguar biologists will say they are definitely coming north as the climate is warming. And really, unless they are able to come up, then jaguar are in very, very imminent danger of going extinct altogether. And then there's also just an incredibly kind of regressive attitude toward wildlife in Mexico, in New Mexico and Arizona. Jaguar are just, they're scary looking. It's another one. Grizzlies and jaguar, I don't need to ever see them. A very positive story about what it takes to protect wildlife movement is the path of the pronghorn. And I did a lot, I write about this in my book, and it's really what I won those journalism awards for, was for this story about the path of the pronghorn. And what's really wonderful is that it's an example of how people working across their disciplines and across jurisdictions got together to do something and were successful. So this was begun by some biologists for the Wildlife Conservation Society who were studying pronghorn in Wyoming and noticed this uptick in their mortality. There was a lot more roadkill of pronghorn right where the fracking was invented. So fracking is invented in these Jonah infield drilling fields, and this, you know, huge industrial onslaught comes in, trucks and drill and mines, you know, not mines, wells, hundreds and hundreds of wells are being drilled. The pronghorn, this path of the pronghorn is at least 6,000 years old, this migration pathway that the single herd has made this migration every year for at least 6,000 years, and it was being disrupted by these mortality. So these biologists went to Niffy Hamilton, who was then the forest supervisor of the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and said, can you help us get protection for this migration? And she said, yes. And when I interviewed her, I said, Niffy, you know, you don't really fit the profile of most Forest Service supervisors, because in a lot of places, particularly rural places, that person is going to be kind of administratively obstreperous. They're not going to help you do something like this. And she really made it happen. She's a hero. And she said to me, Mary Ellen, it was the right thing to do. And I just thought, that's it. That's, you do the right thing. When you see the right thing to do, you do it. That's what Paul Newman said, and that's what we all have to do. So as biologists, forest supervisors, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, people, private citizens, all sorts of people got together, and they got protection for the path of the pronghorn. So that is an example of a good success story, and I'll conclude my presentation with that, and I would love to take your questions.
Our thanks to Mary Ellen Hannibal for telling us about the spine of the continent and for her comments here today. If there are any questions...
Yeah, this was really great. I sort of wanted it off the street, but what a wonderful presentation and lots of knowledge. I have two questions. First, that was very interesting to me, was the fact that you need a certain amount of those grizzly bears in Yellowstone. You said 600 and whatever. And I just wonder, from a genetic point of view, did they study for... you know, gene for mutations, et cetera, from that. And, you know, you transfer that over to the union because, you know, certainly in Amazonian tribes or something, they're isolated where they have. That's one question. The other question is, what's the role of fire on the fauna, and either natural or man-made? And the Indians, of course, had control of burning, but I'd really be interested in you talking about that.
Well, thank you so much for both of those questions. One of the really, when conservation biology was sort of born, it concerned itself a lot with what was the minimum number of animals in a population necessary to keep that population viable. So that number is MVP, minimum viable population, is something that is still used today to calculate things like when a population gets to be put on the endangered species list. So it has been very deeply studied in different kinds of populations. And different animals behave differently and have different reproductive strategies and different reproductive kind of resilience. So that number can be different for different kinds of animals. So yes, it has been very clearly hammered out, especially for grizzly bears, how many you need. It's a political football in the West because ranchers still don't want grizzly bears around, and you know, I don't blame them entirely for that. Of course, you know, I don't want to see a grizzly bear. I'm scared of them, but you know, we have to tolerate them on the landscape. We have to let live and let live. So, you know, this is a bit of a segue or a free association, but I was just asking a scientist about polar bears. She's a marine biologist, well, she's not a marine biologist, but she contributed to another study that's just out about how fast marine animals are moving toward the poles in response to climate change. And I said to her, you know, polar bears are toast. I mean, aren't they? They are not going to they are going to be extinct pretty soon. And she said, yeah, they are. What's going to happen, she said, is that some of them will interbreed with grizzly bears, but they will no longer be polar bears. So that's kind of not the worst story in the world, because they will interbreed with grizzly bears, and that won't happen with some other kinds of species. The fire issue is huge. So fire was suppressed. Along with taking the predators off the landscape, they stopped fire from raging in a natural way. Fire is a very natural ecological occurrence. The Native Americans did do what's called controlled burns, but there's a little bit of a misperception that the way that the Native Americans did things with nature was all wonderful. It worked for them because there weren't that much population. I was in the Grand Canyon, in March for Earth Day, and the curator of the Grand Canyon Museum was showing me the pottery of the Native Americans, and this pottery was thousands of years old. And she explained to me, she said, you know, they had to walk 100 miles to get firewood to fire the kiln, to fire this pottery. And I said, really? They had to walk 100 miles to get the firewood? She said, yes, well, they used all of the wood in their own, where they lived. They extirpated the wood from their own habitation, so they had to go 100 miles out. And this is really the story of humans on the earth. Use up a resource and move on to another source of it. This is the moment in time we are in now where there is no more source. So Native Americans did do controlled burns, and what we want to get back to actually is basically the fire regimes that they did establish, because they've been doing it for quite a long time, and we really can't go back to an ecosystem that was before when Native Americans were doing controlled burns. But this fire in Yosemite is partly a result of suppressing fire. You suppress fire for so long and you build up what's called fuel. And then when it gets, inevitably does light on fire, it burns so high that it destroys the fire, it destroys the forest to a deeper level than it would be if there were these sort of low intensity fires. Although I will say that I've recently started to read some research from some fire ecologists that is showing that even the most severe fires can be beneficial to the ecosystem over the long term. So, you know, we hate to see Yosemite burning, but, you know, and we're so selfish, right, because it's going to come back, but it might take 50 years for it to look kind of like a forest again, and we don't want to wait that long. So we don't want it to ever burn. But even, you know, if you see the where the fires in Yellowstone were like 20 years ago, those forests are coming back. But it's a big problem, and it's really highlights the problem of so much human habitation, because we cannot let these fires burn where people live. The wolves, the trophic cascade dynamic, has a relationship with fire as well. So the more you look into nature and how it all works together, these biotic and abiotic interactions are more and more complex. So, you know, when a fire comes through a forest and then there's a resprouting of aspen, for example, there's going to be a different density of elk coming to eat that aspen, and then you're going to have a different level of predation. So it's all so intricate. But that's why you really need everything going on that you can that's natural.
Right now, we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to The Spine of the Continent with Mary Ellen Hannibal.
That was a fascinating talk. I wonder, with all the research that you've done and all the time now that you've had to think about it, have there been some changes in your personal life that have kind of come about because of what you've learned in terms of researching the book and also the direction of what you might want to be writing about next?
Oh, that's just such a wonderful question. Thank you so much. I mean, I have been completely transformed, basically, by all of this work. And by what I have seen to to understand about what's going on in the world around me. I view it entirely differently, and I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about these things and wanting to help communicate to people what's going on. I am a dyed-in-the-wool English major type of a person, and I was a travel editor and a book review editor in the earlier part of my career. I have been writing about science for about 15 years, but still, I feel that, especially with this particular book, I've had what William James, the great psychologist, brother of Henry James, called a conversion experience. And I have a hard time reading fiction anymore because it's about, you know, domestic dramas. And I'm like, you know what? Okay, that's sort of interesting. It's not that interesting, really. Nature is so fascinating, and it's slipping through our fingers. And I do feel this is the biggest moral question, issue, probably, of humanity ever, because of what's at stake. We are in what's called a sixth mass extinction crisis. So that means that plants and animals are going extinct at a rate that is equal in a rate and magnitude equal to that which took out the dinosaurs. And as I hope you got a sense of, we can't just have this happen without and expect nature to continue to function. You know, and I have two children. I want them to have a future world that is not Mad Max, you know, with people fighting over very scarce resources. So I feel very strongly changed by this. I really do. And I hope to help other people see that actually becoming engaged in the natural world is a very rewarding thing, not only intellectually, but also there's so many wonderful, interesting people, all different kinds of people, scientists, business people, biologists, volunteers. So the book that I'm working on now is about citizen science, which Carol mentioned what citizen science earlier. And citizen science is basically an overarching term for regular people contributing to scientific research. But I use it in a very, very broad way, the citizen side as well as the science side, because when you go and you help pull invasive species in the Presidio, that's not really science, but I consider that citizen science. Being involved doing anything that has to do with restoring nature is, I think, it's fantastic. It makes you happy, be outside, meet people. It's all good. So thank you for asking that question.
Other questions?
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming.
We'd also like to thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.